In the latest in their tour of America, fighting oligarchy, where we go from here. Here's Bernie Sanders.
We're not going to allow you and your friend Mr. Musk and the other billionaires to wreak havoc on the working families of this country. No, you're not going to destroy Social Security. You're not going to destroy Medicaid. You're not going to destroy the Veterans Administration.
Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez rallied with a coalition of progressive allies to fight back against what they call chaos in Washington caused by Donald Trump's policies that hurt American working class people. I'm Teresa Wersbianska for Pacifica Radio.
I'm Elliot Gross, the host of the Don't Forget the Blues Hour. You are tuned to member-supported WPFW in Washington.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, March 21st, 2025. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show, and of course live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on the Darien Gap in Panama to discuss the trauma that migrants face when crossing through the treacherous jungle between Panama and Colombia, not to mention the intangible challenges not discussed in the current immigration debate. And so joining us on the show today is Joshua Collins. He's a freelance reporter based in Colombia, focused on civil rights, migration, and the impact of crime upon human rights. He joins us on the show today from Medellin, Colombia. Welcome back to the show, Joshua Collins.
Thanks, Oscar. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. And joining us for the first time today is Timothy O'Farrell. He is a photojournalist based in Bogota, focused on migration in Latin America. He has an article in NACLA that came out late last year entitled Life Beyond the Darien for Children on the Move. Welcome to the show, Timothy O'Farrell.
Thanks, Oscar. It's wonderful to be here.
Absolutely. So if you hear a little bit of street hustle and bustle in the background, that's because both of our guests are remote in Colombia. So shouldn't be too much of a problem, especially with this discussion that we're having today. So Timothy, I want to start with your NACLA article, which I just mentioned, because right away at the very beginning of your article, you quote a mother who crossed the Darien Gap with the following quote, "The jungle is truly the worst thing that can exist," end quote. This is a jarring statement to make of this part of Latin America that serves, in my opinion, as the basis to your article. So let's begin by discussing the growing recognition this treacherous journey is having on people that cross it, for those who may not know.
Yeah, so this article kind of came out of some reporting that I did through Central America. So Joshua and I, earlier in the year, were on the Colombian side of the Darien Gap, but later in the year, I went to the Central American side. And speaking with both migrants and with aid groups, sort of one of the major things that came up was the mental health challenges that not that everyone was facing, but especially that children were facing. And so with respect to language, with respect to the ability to diagnose people on the move is a major challenge that I'm sure we'll talk about again. And the differences in culture and religion and language again that happens or that manifests, let's say, when you have people coming from all different parts of the world. So these aren't only Latinos who speak Spanish, but these are people who are coming from Africa and Asia. And so they have different concepts of mental health. So that adds another barrier to diagnosing or to responding to the mental health challenges. And to speak a little bit on sort of why these mental health challenges build up is that, you know, these people for each have justified their reason to leave their home, whether it's get through gang violence, whether it's economic difficulty or whatever. We all know many of the different reasons that migrants have to justify their reason to leave. And so that itself can contribute to trauma. And then especially for children, which was the focus of this article, is that these children are leaving their schools, they're leaving their friends, their families, and their communities in order to go to a place that they probably know very little about. And often they've been told they're going on a holiday. So you'll see a bit, that's a common theme speaking to migrants. And the same was when Joshua and I were in Colombia, is that a lot of parents are telling their children that this is going to be sort of an adventure. We're going to go on a holiday, because it's very difficult to tell a 10-year-old child, a 12-year-old child, a 5-year-old child, the truth about what's going on at the Darien Gap. And then added to that, so that's a few examples of where the trauma can come from, but then added to that is what actually happens in the Darien. So, you know, the Darien on the Colombian side is controlled by an armed group in Colombia. Then you're prone to abuses of sexual nature, of physical nature. You're prone to being robbed. And then also just the physical challenge of 3, 4, 5 days in the jungle with very little food, with very little equipment. So all of these things combined really contribute to a lot of mental health challenges faced by these people in migration, especially amongst children, because children don't have sort of the concept of understanding what's going on as adults often do. And so that adds another thing in there. And yeah, speaking with NGOs and aid groups in Central America, that seems to be a thing that they're increasingly noticing and conscious of, but at the same time, I would say failing to respond adequately to.
It's certainly a Pandora's box. It certainly deserves a very nuanced conversation. And we're certainly going to expand a lot more on some of the things that you just mentioned right now. I want to know if Joshua can elaborate a little bit more to what Timothy just said, because in addition to Timothy's NACLA article, you and Timothy actually wrote a joint article for the New Humanitarian last year entitled "As Darien Migration Goes Global, Language Becomes a Major Challenge," which is another issue included to what Timothy just said. So I wanted to know, Joshua, if you could elaborate or add a little bit more to what Timothy just mentioned here on this issue.
Yeah, I think one of the things that stood out the most for me as part of the series that we did at the Humanitarian, Tim and I did an article and spent a few weeks up there, and then I spent a few more weeks afterwards as part of like a 4-part series, was that there's very little state response to the humanitarian needs of this population. So Colombia prefers to sort of ignore the problem. There's very little state presence outside of Necoclí, like the one little sort of bay town before the Darien Gap. And there's not even a lot of presence of humanitarian organizations in the Darien Gap, because as Tim mentioned, it's controlled by one of the biggest armed groups in Colombia, the EGC, the Gaitanista Army of Colombia. And then on the Panamanian side, there is a actively hostile attitude towards a lot of these migrants. So you have sort of civil society or the Colombian Red Cross trying to fill these huge gaps in humanitarian needs, and they just don't have translators. Now, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but last year when we were in the Darien Gap, we met migrants from Africa, from the Middle East, from various parts of Asia, probably heard a dozen different languages. And neither medical staff nor psychological staff, within the very little amount of humanitarian aid that is available, they speak almost entirely Spanish. Some of them spoke a little bit of English as well. But we encountered migrants from Africa who were having difficulty communicating with the doctors. And this becomes a more critical issue in times of medical emergency or psychological distress. We were told by Médicos Sin Fronteras that they had treated a woman who they didn't know where she was from when she showed up because nobody in the aid station spoke her language. It turned out that she was from Kenya. They were trying to get translators from UNICEF to come down to identify her language. So they couldn't even sort of identify the problem that she was having. It was psychological distress related to stress that had caused a sort of a crisis moment, shall we say. But it had taken like 4 or 5 hours before finally they had gotten someone on the phone that was part of UNICEF in another country that was trying to live translate through this mental health crisis in real time. And it's just sort of a micro example of how the organizations that are on the ground are underfunded, they're understaffed, and they just simply do not have the resources, especially at that time when so many people were crossing, to deal with the needs of these vulnerable communities.
So, Timothy, is there anything you want to expand with the issue of non-Spanish speakers with regards to those who cross the Darien Gap, especially with the lack of resources that aid groups have? Now, Joshua just mentioned, you know, the lack of interpreters for these specific languages, but also the issue of technology, because while we have the modern means of communications with smartphones, they can only do so much. And even in remote areas like the Darien Gap, which I would imagine does not have the best Wi-Fi in the world. And so even if you had the best iPad or smartphone or whatever, it could only do so much under these treacherous circumstances, correct?
Yeah, that's completely correct. And I think I'd begin by adding, in addition to language, what comes up in these situations is also people's culture and religion. And so we find that whilst we can maybe agree on a couple core facets of mental health, and maybe we can communicate through Google Translate or something like that, my understanding by and large of mental health is largely influenced by my culture. And if I'm coming from Latin America, it's influenced by my culture and my religion. If I'm coming from the Middle East, which many of these migrants are coming from, it's influenced by their Islamic faith, the same in Africa as well. And for other people coming maybe of Buddhist or Hindu faith from Asia. And so I think not only do we have a difficulty in sort of having these conversations around mental health because of language, but in addition, our concept of mental health and what we understand, and even, you know, these people are coming from quite historically conservative countries, a number of them, where mental health is still a taboo topic. And so what I found, especially with the children, is that many families were reluctant to let their child speak to a psychologist. This is, you know, according to what the psychologists in Central America were telling me, because they don't believe or they don't share the values of this humanitarian organization, or they don't believe they have the best interests of their child in mind, or they just don't recognize that mental health might be a factor in their migration journey.
Yeah, I think another factor that was mentioned to me by Amit, who is from Somalia, is that in his culture, it's sort of frowned upon to go seek help from someone outside of your family. Like the idea that you would do that would be considered a sort of sign of either weakness or just like bad judgment. The idea that like a lot of these problems are kept in the house and like your family helps you solve them. But what do you do in a region where you have no support network, or that social group that aids you in those moments is not present?
It's interesting that you brought that up, because I actually do have that clip that you included in your new humanitarian article from last year, having this conversation with this migrant named Ahmed. So actually, I'll play the clip right here. The audio is a little choppy, but I think it's worth listening to, because you can hear a little bit about the uncertainty in his voice when he's discussing what's going to happen next as he makes this journey. So let's take a listen.
What is your first name?
My first name is Ahmed Abdi.
And where are you from?
I'm from Somalia.
And can you tell me a little bit about your trip so far?
My trip was so difficult. I passed a lot of problems. I thank God I just arrived now in Colombia. And I'll try my luck there.
Could you tell us, your friends said that they got robbed by Peruvian police.
My friends got robbed by the Peruvian police, and they just robbed their money, their food. They are not there, they are just starving, they don't have something to eat, and there's no way to cook. Yeah,
and tomorrow you guys cross the jungle.
Yeah, tomorrow we cross the jungle.
And could you maybe just briefly tell me about why you left Somalia?
Somalia right now, the situation in Somalia is not good. You know, there's no stable government there. Them themselves, they are fighting, you see. Yeah, there's no, we cannot survive there. You know, the terrorist groups there, they want you to recruit, to join them. We don't want to fight. We don't want to fight. We want to live in peace. And, you know, yeah, we want to create a life and live in harmony. Yeah.
And if you can get into the United States, what would you like to do?
Yeah, United States is a big country. I want them to welcome me and give me a chance. And if they give me a chance, I would like to return them something. And I would like to create a life, a good life. Yeah.
So that's the voice of a migrant named Ahmed, who, as you heard towards the end, is just trying to seek a good life. And I played that because there's so much that you could grab from his voice in terms of fear and uncertainty that a lot of migrants that make that journey day to day make and have that in mind. And keep in mind that one of the reasons why we're having this conversation is because the Darien Gap and the challenges that migrants face going through there is not discussed here in the American immigration debate as often as it should, if at all. So Joshua, I'm curious to know if you want to add a little bit more to this conversation that you had with Ahmed here.
You know, Oscar, I think you bring up a really important point, at least from the perspective within North America and the United States. Our focus is always on the immediate frontier with Mexico, and that's ignoring a huge aspect of this journey. So the migration corridor that runs from Colombia to Mexico, well, the northern part of Mexico, that land migration route is the most dangerous land migration route in the world. The Darien is only one of many challenges that a lot of these migrants have to overcome. They also have to cross through Central America, where they're regularly extorted and sometimes harassed or even sexually assaulted by even security forces, as well as criminal elements. And then arguably the most dangerous part of the journey is traversing Mexico itself. So Mexico has these programs now where they're helping the U.S. to enforce migration. The idea under the Biden administration was they wanted less people to arrive at the U.S. border. So they sort of outsourced a lot of this migration enforcement. So Mexico will detain people and then ship them back south. So it's like this chutes and ladders game. This dynamic is, of course, continuing and perhaps even becoming more strict under the Trump administration. So whenever I'm doing fieldwork in the Darien or anywhere else on migration, I always try to stay in touch with all of the people that we interview. The vast majority of them don't, and that's understandable. We all have busy lives and obligations, and I don't take it personally. But Ahmed actually did stay in touch with me, and I talked to him just 2 weeks ago. He's in Minneapolis, Minnesota now, renting a room from a Somali family that are also migrants. He was lucky enough to get an appointment through the CBP1 app. Some migrants face like 2 to 3 month waiting periods to get asylum hearings through that app, but he was lucky enough to get through, likely because, so there's a quota system for each country. Likely he did not have to wait as long as some other migrants because there's just not a lot of Somali migrants in the waiting list. That app has, of course, now been dismantled by the Trump administration. But where I'm going with all of this is that what we see in the U.S. is coverage, understandably, focused on the immediate border or migrants that are already in the country and kind of how they're adapting or what challenges they're facing. But this man crossed half of a continent, right? He came from Somali Africa, flew to Peru because that was a place where Somalis can enter at the time with a visa, a tourist visa, so they didn't have to ask for a visa. Traveled by land, was robbed by Peruvian police on a bus through Ecuador, through Colombia, up through north to the Darien Gap. And he traversed three continents because he wants to have a better life and he doesn't want to be forced into joining either an armed criminal group or an armed like religious fanatic group is the way he described it to me. There's a series of conflicts within Somalia. You'd have to get a different expert on that country specifically. I'm just repeating what he told me. But the idea was that he was a recent college graduate and he didn't want to be drawn into conflict against his will. And so the fact that someone would take such a perilous long journey really speaks to the idea that U.S. enforcement policy is not just on the border, it's global. The U.S. has enlisted other countries to help them in this enforcement.
Profoundly. Yeah, thank you for making that last point, because that's something that should be mentioned a lot more often than it should, and certainly lends itself to the challenges that migrants face, the psychological challenges that migrants face in the Darien Gap, which leads me back to Timothy's NACLA article, because Timothy, you cited Alejandra Angulo, who's a psychologist with the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, and she said the following, quote, "Parents often tell us that their children are no longer the same as when they left," said Angulo. "For instance, we have had parents who report that their children were happier and more communicative when they left their home country. But as they continue the journey, this turns into a regression and a lack of communication due to the fears they face," end quote. Could you expand on this statement as a reminder that most mental health disorders cannot be diagnosed in transit? I think a lot of people may not be aware of that fact, but please elaborate.
Yeah, and I think this kind of ties back to the point I made earlier, which is sort of that a lot of families are telling their kids that they're going on an adventure. And so we see that children are arriving, whether it's crossing the border from Venezuela or wherever they may be coming from, they're in an okay state. They're going on bus trips. Maybe they're sleeping in tents. Maybe they're paying for accommodation. But by and large, things are okay, unless they've, unfortunately, like we've seen many times, they've been abused or robbed at borders, which is commonplace throughout the Americas. But the Darien Gap for many of these people is often the first realization of, okay, we're no longer on a family holiday. This is quite a scary thing. We're sleeping in tents. We're sleeping on the jungle floor for 3, 4, 5 days. We're crossing through rivers that are up to our chests and shoulders and things like that. So that's kind of where someone might initially be quite communicative and happy about the experience, then becomes sort of appears a bit traumatized, or at least takes a step back on the communication side of things. With respect to diagnosing mental health, one of the major things that Angulo and many others mentioned there, this from this perspective of the psychologists, is it might just not be helpful to receive a diagnosis during those periods of migration, because it can be quite traumatic to receive a diagnosis like that. And maybe that might be better for these people when ideally they get settled into somewhere in the US, and then they can kind of have a wrapped around service supporting them. Because when you diagnose somebody in a aid center in Honduras or Guatemala or wherever it may be, there's no services there to follow up from that. And actually, one of the sort of faults of the aid groups, in my perspective, is their communication between one another and between even their own organization across these countries. So you might arrive in Panama and the Red Cross might diagnose you with post-traumatic stress disorder, but you arrive in Honduras at the Red Cross and they don't know you've got post-traumatic stress disorder. So they're going to re-diagnose you and look into that trauma, and you're going to have to tell your story again, which is sometimes just not the best thing. So Angulo and a few other people instead emphasized that having spaces like safe spaces where children can instead, for maybe 30 minutes, an hour during the day, can have a space to be a child, to draw, to talk with friends, to kick a ball around, or just talk about whatever they want to do, which allows them to sort of relax a little bit, because often these people are migrating in sort of a fight or flight mode. And those spaces allow children to calm down and just feel a little bit like a child, which is really important in those spaces.
That point you bring up about aid groups not doing a very good job of sharing information is something that has been raised to me multiple times by multiple different organizations. And I heard kind of an interesting off the record, so I won't say who told me this, but somebody who was working in coordinating aid group responses in Colombia told me that he believes this comes fundamentally from a lack of resources. So if UNICEF has a perspective or a data set that perhaps another aid organization that's working in the region does not have, they can use that as leverage with their donors. They're like, look, we're providing an invaluable insights. So they don't have a motive to share this information, right? In fact, they have a motive not to. And this comes from a scarcity of resources, right? Like as donor bases drop, most of these, not all, but most of these humanitarian aid organizations are funded by big donors, right? So they're competing for an ever-shrinking pool of resources. And this is one of the obstacles for making communication between all these groups more transparent. It leads to a lot of the problems, exactly what you're describing, Tim. And another issue that he brought up to me was that, for example, Panama publishes numbers daily on the amount of people who arrive from the Darien Gap. Colombia sort of kind of collects numbers on who leaves Colombia, but they're not very trustworthy because they're not implemented widely and always. But they don't even have a data set where they can say, okay, well, 500 people left Colombia for the Darien Gap today. So in the next 3 or 4 days, there should be 500 people arriving in Panama. That'd be a very simple way to determine like the safety of migrants passing. But neither humanitarian aid groups nor the Colombian government are talking with their counterparts in terms of those data sets on the Panamanian side. And this would be a very simple thing to implement, but there's just no political will to do so.
And as a result of this disorganization and lack of communication, none of us will really know the long-term effects that this will have on both children and adults alike, this treacherous journey through the Darien Gap, because as Joshua mentioned earlier, it's not just the Darien Gap itself, but all these journeys throughout all of Central America and throughout most of Mexico that will unfortunately lead to like a repetition of the very trauma that they had initially in places like the Darien Gap, like Peru and Ecuador, as the Somali migrant had described as well. And so, again, it lets me reiterate the issue that this is a Pandora's box that deserves this nuanced conversation that we're having right here. So we're going to take a break right now. We're speaking with Joshua Collins, who's a freelance reporter based in Colombia, and Timothy O'Farrell, who's a photojournalist based in Bogota, Colombia. His November article in NACLA is entitled Life Beyond the Darien for Children on the Move. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Me llaman el desaparecido. Cuando llega ya se ha ido. Volando vengo, volando voy. Deprisa, deprisa, rumbo perdido. Cuando me buscan nunca estoy. Cuando me encuentran yo no soy el que está enfrente porque ya me fui corriendo más allá. Me dicen el desaparecido, fantasma que nunca está. Me dicen el desagradecido, pero esa no es la verdad. Yo llevo en el cuerpo un dolor que no me deja respirar. Llevo en el cuerpo una condena que siempre me echa a caminar. Me dicen el desaparecido, que cuando llega ya se ha ido. Volando vengo, volando voy, deprisa, deprisa, rumbo perdido. Me dicen el desaparecido, fantasma que nunca está. Me dicen el desagradecido, pero esa no es la verdad. Yo llevo en el cuerpo un motor que nunca deja de rolar. Llevo en el alma un camino destinado a nunca llegar. Cuando me buscan nunca estoy, cuando me encuentran yo no soy el que está enfrente porque ya me fui corriendo más allá. Me dicen el desaparecido, cuando llega ya se ha ido. Volando vengo, volando voy, deprisa, deprisa, rumbo perdido, perdido en el siglo, perdido en el siglo. Siglo XX. ¿Cuándo llegaré? ¿Cuándo llegaré? ¿Cuándo llegaré? Rumbo al 21. ¿Cuándo llegaré? Me llaman el desaparecido. ¿Cuándo llegaré? Perdido en el siglo. ¿Cuándo llegaré? ¿Cuándo llegaré? Me llaman el desaparecido. Me
dicen el desaparecido, fantasma que nunca está. Me dicen el desagradecido, esa no es la verdad. Yo llevo en el cuerpo un motor que nunca deja de rodar. Llevo en el alma un camino destinado a nunca llegar. Me llaman el desaparecido, que cuando llega ya se ha ido. Volando vengo, volando voy, deprisa, deprisa, rumbo perdido.
Was Manu Chao, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you also follow us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. You can also follow us on latinomediacollective.com and, of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're focusing on stories from the Darien Gap with Joshua Collins, who's a freelance reporter based in Medellin, Colombia, and Timothy O'Farrell, who's a photojournalist based in Bogota, Colombia. And so we're talking about the Darien Gap between Panama and Colombia. And Timothy, I'll start with you here. What has been the response by the Panamanian President José Raúl Mulino with regards to people migrating via the Darien Gap? Obviously, as we have this conversation, we're pretty mindful and aware of this ridiculous story from the Trump administration of retaking the Panama Canal. And the Panamanian president has been staunchly against the idea, or has presented himself as being staunchly against it. But at the same time, there's something else that needs to be addressed here, because as Joshua mentioned, that this immigration policy from the current administration in the U.S. is not exclusive only to the U.S.-Mexico border, but it's global and includes cases like the Darien Gap. And so while the Panamanian president is telling us one thing, he's doing something else in the Darien Gap.
From my perspective, I think Mulino has acted almost as a puppet of the U.S., and correct me if you think I'm wrong, Joshua, but from my perspective, especially during the Biden administration in 2024, there was an intent to set up fences and really deter migrants from coming. I watched many of these videos on Facebook where migrants communicate with one another. And it seems these fences acted as a minor deterrence, and at least they garnered a bit of media attention, so that sort of trickles down and people reconsider their decision to leave. But largely it was an unsuccessful attempt at deterring migration. Earlier in the year, I believe in February, Médicos Sin Fronteras was banned from operating in the Darien region, and that was after they were calling on the Panamanian government. This was before Mulino, but it's been updated since, to do more to protect migrants, especially with respect to sexual abuse. So there was a 1 week where there was over 200 cases of sexual abuse reported to MSF in the Darien region. And so they sort of made a sort of a media feel about that and called on the Panamanian government to do more. And quite quickly after that, they were banned from operating within the Darien region. In November last year, I believe, with the MSF and the Ministry of Health in Panama, MSF were able to return. And I believe that was under Mulino. So that's a positive sign that they were able to negotiate at some level to provide care, because the services of MSF, it's often spoken as the most important NGO and working in the region, at least according to a number of the psychologists that I spoke to. They often said that MSF was providing the most important services to the migrants, especially with respect to mental and physical health of migrants.
So MSF, unlike a lot of other humanitarian organizations in the region, they have more than just general practitioners in their staff. They have psychologists. They have people that are specialists in various problems that are common in the Darien Gap that UNICEF, for example, simply doesn't have. They just don't have that kind of staff. But I think that episode of them being removed from being allowed in the Panamanian side of the Darien was a pretty clear, unspoken signal that the Panamanian government is only going to allow humanitarian organizations to operate as long as they're not criticizing the Panamanian government, which is rather chilling.
Indeed. And again, I said before, it's a Pandora's box that needs to be addressed. And that alone is a one-hour conversation in and of itself. Joshua, I want to go back to the new humanitarian article. to discuss sort of the diversity of the people who have made this journey through the Darien Gap. And one thing I noticed on the list that you have on this article is quite a few people from places like Afghanistan, Cameroon, India, countries that have various degrees of a sizable Muslim population. I wonder if you could discuss a little bit more about the diversity of the people that are going through this journey through the Darien Gap, because I also have to mention that as we have this conversation this month, there is rumors again of the Trump administration reviving the Muslim ban that he had in his first administration. So I think considering that as something that's looming on the horizon, possibly, this I think needs to be addressed as well.
Well, the idea of a Muslim ban at this point in history is kind of like, it would be a PR move. Asylum has been dismantled. The beginning of the process of dismantling asylum occurred under the Biden administration. He set huge barriers that had never existed before and likely was breaking both U.S. and international law by denying people on U.S. soil the right to even apply for asylum. Now, Trump has doubled down on that. There is no longer even the CPV1 app. So how do you apply for asylum in the U.S.? Well, you don't. I mean, so like, the idea that they're going to make a Muslim ban is just seems like one of those things Trump does for attention. Like, the man likes to say racist things, and that gets him a lot of news stories and hits on social media, and that's his strategy for governing. But having said that, while we were in the Darien at the time, there was a big explosion in migrants from Asia and from Africa, obviously both regions which have large Muslim populations. And that was because they're no longer allowed to fly into the United States, obviously, but they would previously fly into Mexico City and then try to cross from there. This goes back to our conversation about how border enforcement has been outsourced to the entire globe, sort of at the demands of wealthy nations in the global north. Some people, I don't know necessarily whether they were Muslim or not. I could make guesses based on the countries they were from, language, stuff like that. But I mean, I guess I would just like to stress that it was a really, really diverse population. I mean, we talked to people from Bangladesh, we talked to people from Afghanistan, we talked to people from various countries in Africa, we talked to people from China, we talked to people from Taiwan. I mean, so the Darien became a really international hub for people to get from South America to Central America because regulations prevent them from just flying into North America, Mexico specifically. So this is just, to me, it's just sort of an inevitable consequence of this idea that the world is becoming more and more nativist as time goes on.
Yeah, I might just add another point to that, which links in a bit more to double down on my point about Panama almost playing the role of a puppet. And Molino, we've seen recently that Ecuador has restricted some of the ability to receive a visa in Ecuador. But historically, as Joshua mentioned, it's been very difficult for people, especially from outside of Latin America, to enter into a Central American country and then travel up. And so one of the reasons that explains why Darien migration was so high in 2023 and 2024 is because people need to arrive into places in countries like Ecuador, who historically have had very laxed visa restrictions, where people from Somalia and Afghanistan can enter fairly freely and travel up there. And that again doubles down the point on how the Central American countries have acted as a puppet for the U.S. The U.S. has said, I want you to restrict the visas of who, you know, I want you to not give visas to people coming from Somalia or coming from Afghanistan. And I'm paraphrasing here. And that was the same under the Biden administration. It was, I want you to build a fence and restrict migration. And the initial goal was to completely cut off migration under Molino and the Biden administration. And then even now, the last few days, we've seen that the U.S. has asked Panama to store migrants in the south in the Darien region for a few days before they then have expatriate flights. And we've just seen in the last few days that the Associated Press has reported that these people have been released into Panama and have a 30-day visa waiver. And we're not sure what's going to happen following that. But that was after a lot of pressure from human rights groups and lawyers essentially trying to hold the U.S. government and the Panamanian government accountable for the humanitarian abuses going on down there.
It's treating human beings as pawns in this case. And I'm glad that you mentioned the issue of Ecuador, because Ecuador is a head case in and of itself. We just did a show last month on institutional racism in Ecuador, and that sort of serves as a reminder that for somebody, say, for example, Ahmed, who Joshua interviewed, not only do they have to make the journey through Ecuador, which has a right-wing government, Peru also has a right-wing government, as does Panama, as does Costa Rica, as does El Salvador. And so these are the challenges, the intangible challenges that migrants are facing as well, these institutional racism that appears to various degrees in some of the countries that I just mentioned. So, Timothy, under these unique and difficult circumstances, what efforts and or recommendations are being made to help children in particular? Because you cited a researcher, a Colombian researcher by the name of Alejandra Salazar, who's also a psychologist specializing in family migration. Can you tell us about the importance of these sort of things, however limited the resources may be in some of these organizations that we mentioned earlier? I think this is still worth mentioning as, at the very least, some effort to try to help children who make this journey.
Yeah, and Alejandra is a really interesting researcher. She has experience both in a Latin American context, but also in the European context with migrants arriving on the boat into countries like Spain and sort of needing to offer immediate responses to their mental health needs, but also long-term things. And I think, unfortunately, what we see in the Darien and Alejandro and many others double down on this is it's a crisis. And so many of these aid organizations don't have the resources, as Joshua mentioned, to set things up for the future. Unfortunately, many of these people are traveling undocumented. It's uncertain whether they're going to arrive to the US. So the responses happening on the ground in Central America after the Darien and through Mexico and things are very much a response in a situation of crisis. What does that mean? That means that they're short-term, quick things. They're like, okay, people need basic needs like food and water and just feel safe. And maybe some need a conversation with a psychologist and some may need to be diagnosed or need to have a conversation around sort of some of the post-traumatic stress disorders or depression that might be coming up. But by and large, these are quite quick responses that we're seeing in the Central American region. And so, unfortunately, as you mentioned at the beginning, a lot of the onus lies on the US and on the host countries of where these migrants will end up. And that's, there's a lot of research out there of the need for good integration. And I think whether we look at the US or we look at Germany, many countries have attempted it at reintegration or integration into societies. And today we're seeing the backlash of potentially a failed attempt at integration into societies, where we see an increase in polarization between different communities because people aren't encouraged or aren't offered the resources to learn the languages or to understand the cultural needs. And on the other hand, that many locals are unable to understand the cultural differences between them and the newly arrived migrants.
I think it stems a lot more from the latter than the former. I mean, we have a lot of studies on how well migrants tend to what nativists tend to call assimilate, right? It's a loaded term. We could have a whole hour-long conversation about that. But the truth is that migrants are pretty good at that. Like this idea that this reactionary nativist movement is a response to migration itself is not, I cannot agree with that at all. It's a reactionary movement to failed policy, perhaps. So like people talk about migration crises, right? And we have humanitarian crises. We've spent the last half an hour talking about them. But I mean, migration doesn't cause crises. Poor border policy causes crises. If those people didn't have to walk across an entire continent, they wouldn't be suffering life-threatening circumstances doing so. If they could simply fly to New York or fly to London or anywhere else that they choose to go, like as the world worked for the vast majority of its history, then none of these crises, in parentheses, would be happening. So this reactionary movement that we see in Europe and these anti-migration sentiments, and we certainly see it in the US right now, this is, to me, like a lot of this is people trying to rationalize a illogical and irrational response that's based on bigotry. And that's really all there is to it. And you can rationalize bigotry as much as you want, but it's still bigotry, right? So it's our policies that are failing us, right? It's not migrants that are failing us. It's what we force them to do and how we fail to incorporate them into these societies. I mentioned I was still in touch with him. He still feels like an outsider in the U.S. He's worried that with the Trump administration, his ongoing asylum process will be canceled and that he'll be deported back to Somalia. It's been difficult for him to get a job. He doesn't feel like, well, I should rather say he feels it's been difficult for him to make friends out of the Somali migrant community, that outside of this Somali migrant community where he's currently staying, Now, these are not failures of migration. These are failures of policy, right? Like, it shouldn't be hard for him to get a job. It shouldn't be hard for him, or he shouldn't be scared to go outside because he's worried someone's going to call ICE on him, right? Like, these are societal problems. These are not problems that stem from migration itself. Do you understand the distinction I'm trying to draw, Oscar?
Absolutely. And this is why I wanted to address this part of the NACLA article, because it really was a bitter pill to swallow to read that part, because it just shows the institutional failures, not just with regards to Panama and Colombia, but throughout every other country throughout this journey that migrants make. You know what I'm saying? And it's not the fault of the migrants, as you said as well. Now, before we actually recorded this conversation, you guys pointed out to me that there's some important updates with regards to the number of people who are going through the Darien Gap that you guys believe is worth mentioning. And I'll start with Timothy here, if you could give us an update on the numbers, because the new humanitarian article that I mentioned earlier was written by the both of you in June, and your NACLA article was written late last year. So what updates should we point out here that deserve our attention?
Yeah, well, the Ministry of Migration in Panama publishes every month a recording of the number of migrants that have passed through the border. And Joshua mentioned before, Colombia has somewhat of an attempt at recording the statistics and the number of people leaving Colombia. But Panama, we can be confident that their numbers are pretty good. And so in this year so far, there's only been a total of about 2,600 people that have migrated in the first 2 months. And I don't have the exact numbers of 2024 on me. Joshua, you might have those, but I think it was more in the 20,000 sort of thing. And even in February, we've seen a decrease from 2,200 in January to now only 408 in the month of February. So that's a significant decrease, and certainly the lowest number of migration through the Darien since probably 2020 during the COVID pandemic.
To put those numbers in context, when Tim and I were last in the Darien Gap was in July of 2024, and depending on the day, there were between 500 and 1,000 people crossing a day, arriving in Panama at least. And according to the numbers that Tim just mentioned, that would put them at about 13 people a day, which is a massive drop-off.
A massive drop-off, it is worth mentioning. But at the same time, by no means does it take away the psychological damage that this has done to both children and adults alike, because as we mentioned quite earlier, is that none of us here in this conversation will really know the long-term effects of going through this journey and what children have seen during the course of this whole treacherous journey through the Darien Gap. And again, I have to stress again that it's not the fault of migrants, as Joshua said. It is an institutional failure from all these countries with regards to the lack of communication, the lack of resources that have been pointing out here. And chances are those same issues are still happening even as we have this conversation today. There's so much more here that I would like to address, but I will say this, that I'm going to create a link to both articles on our Twitter account so people can learn more about not only what's going on, but the stories of the migrants themselves and the statistics that you guys presented in these articles as well. So Joshua, what else do you hope people learn from this particular article that was written in June of last year in the New Humanitarian that also deserves our attention that we may not have addressed thus far, but is something that you would like to point out at this portion of the conversation?
I've been reporting from various borders for a decade now, and I think the indisputable lesson the indisputable lesson that I have learned is that border enforcement, as draconian attempts to militarize borders and prevent migration from happening, doesn't work. We have decades of data on this, and we just mentioned that the numbers right now in the Darien are really low. Well, they're the lowest since Trump took office for his first term in 2021. That's the last time these numbers were this low. So what we're seeing right now is that a lot of these smuggling networks or guides, because they're not all, this term human smuggling is also very loaded, right? Is someone who takes willing people across a river because he knows the terrain a human smuggler? I would argue that they're not. Basically, this entire industry that has sprung up because of the criminalization of migration is doing two things. One, they're waiting to see what the actual policy is from Trump, because we still have a lot of questions about that. You mentioned this idea of a possible Muslim ban. A lot of his policies are very opaque, right? Like, we don't really understand what they're going to do. He likes to make big announcements and then maybe or maybe not follow up. His words are very untrustworthy when it comes to what he says he will do. So a lot of these, just like the last time he took office, a lot of these structures are waiting to see what he'll do. And also, it's displacing the current movement. So I like to think of migration as water running down a hill, right? Water will follow the path of least resistance, and it will forge new paths. And if you put up an obstacle in the path of water, it will forge new paths around that obstacle. Migration works in the exact same manner. So what we're seeing right now is a sort of pause to see what Trump's policies mean for the entire region. Last time, his first term, within 3 months, the numbers were back up to what they'd been before he took office. Now, I don't know if we'll see the same dramatic return or not this time, but we'll certainly see an increase. And I guess what I'd like to communicate most to anyone who's interested in this topic is that the only thing that militarized borders and draconian border policy does is force people into more dangerous situations and empowers criminal groups, because criminal groups are inevitably the ones who impose control over black markets. And when you tell people they have no official means of entering a country, they will find unofficial means. And those markets are inevitably dominated by people who do not have good intentions and prey upon those very migrants that they're supposed to be selling a service to, shall we say.
Yeah, there's a lot more to be mentioned with regards to the informal economy in Latin America and how it fits into everything that we discussed thus far. So likewise, Timothy, we're going to create a link to your NACLA article that you wrote late last year. Is there anything from your article that you want to address that we haven't done thus far that deserves a spotlight right now, especially perhaps without putting any words into your mouth with regards to children as well? Because that was one of the central things that was in your article. But what else should we take under consideration here?
Yeah, sure. And I think this ties into to sharing my agreement with the point that Joshua made in terms of the responsibility on the integration of migrants being on the host governments. And I think I say that in the sense that it also, the responsibility needs to be on governments where migrants are migrating through. And I say this in reference to Central American nations, who many of whom have essentially washed their hands of this migration problem. So we have countries like Panama and Costa Rica, which you can read more about in the article, where they offer bus services to families to travel through the country, and they essentially cross the entire country in a day. But other countries like Honduras and Nicaragua, for example, have just washed their hands of this issue. And so people are left to go into, you know, very public spaces, potentially into the capital as well, and try and find themselves a ride there. And I think the onus needs to be on these Central American countries and realizing that whether now we know Darien migration has decreased, but Central American people are still going to continue to migrate towards the United States. And so this is going to continue to be an issue. And so they need to provide services for buses and aid stations where people can receive these mental health and physical health services that are available. And this is paramount for children in those spaces who need spaces to be able to feel safe for a moment during that journey. Because as we know, and the psychologists know in the article I spoke with, continuing this trauma and not allowing a space to release what you're feeling only adds and exasperates the potential of post-traumatic stress disorder, which they might be diagnosed with when they arrive into the US. And so specifically on the side of children, it's really, really important that they are given the opportunity to express these emotions during their journey, because these journeys can take many months at a time.
You've spoken a lot about the treacherous jungle known as the Darien Gap in a variety of ways. But even in this hour-long conversation, I still feel like we've only touched the tip of the iceberg here. We should definitely mention the issue of climate change and how it affects migration when people are going through this dangerous area in Latin America. But again, like I said before, we just hit the tip of the iceberg of this conversation. And it's only possible to expand on it with fantastic guests like we had today. So we've been speaking with Joshua Collins, who's a freelance reporter based in Medellin, Colombia. Joshua, thank you for fighting the good fight. Keep up the great work. And thank you for being on the show with us once again.
Thanks for having me, Oscar. I guess I would just point out that I've been kind of a little frustrated with U.S. policy lately. And so if I was a bit pointed in some of my remarks, that doesn't mean I don't mean them. It just means that this seems like a bit of a dark moment in the world to me, as someone who's covered migration for a decade.
hey, that's the basis of the show. So you're in good company right now. And likewise, Timothy O'Farrell is a photojournalist based in Bogota, Colombia. Again, thank you for fighting the good fight. Keep up the great work. And thank you for being on the show with us, Timothy.
Thanks, Oscar. A privilege to talk about these issues with you. And hopefully we can talk again in a few years and we'll have some solutions come to the table.
Absolutely. You got it. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. President Trump signed an executive order yesterday giving Education Secretary Linda McMahon the authority to do all she can to dismantle the Department of Education. Trump said, quote, "We're going to shut it down as quickly as possible," close quote. But the order stops short of immediately closing the department, which cannot be done without congressional approval, which would require the support of at least 7 Democratic senators. Meanwhile, the White House stated that the administration would move to cut parts of the department that remain within legal boundaries. Last week, the department announced it is cutting its workforce by nearly 50%. And even though Trump said everybody supports dismantling the Education Department, criticism of the mandate was swift and the threat of litigation is looming. Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, said in a statement anticipating the executive order, quote, "We will see you in court," close quote. And House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries accused Trump of taking a chainsaw to public education in America. Quote, "Shutting down the Department of Education will harm millions of children in our nation's public schools, their families, and hard-working teachers," close quote. In other news, the Justice Department said today it is considering invoking the state's secrets privilege in its ongoing court battle over providing details concerning the Trump administration's deportation of 200 Venezuelan alleged gang members. Judge James Boasberg yesterday called the information the government has provided him so far, quote, "woefully insufficient," close quote. The conflict involves an order Boasberg issued Saturday temporarily barring the administration from using the Wartime Alien Enemies Act, which allows the deportation of migrants without a hearing of any sort, but only in times of war or invasion. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has admitted in federal court documents that many Venezuelans it accused of being dangerous gang members and deported have no criminal records in the United States, but argued it was only because they had only been in the U.S. briefly. In more news, a federal judge issued a temporary restraining order blocking the Social Security Administration from giving members of Elon Musk's Doge team access to agency data containing individuals' personally identifiable information. The judge said the Trump administration had failed to show why the group needed broad access to millions of Americans' sensitive data and likened the Doge team's demands to a fishing expedition. She also ordered Doge affiliates to delete any personally identifiable information they had already acquired from the agency and to remove any software they had installed on the Social Security Administration's computer system. And Russia launched a large-scale drone attack on the southern Ukrainian port city of Odessa overnight that hit civilian infrastructure, injured at least 3 people, and sparked a massive blaze. The strike came just days after President Trump attempted to negotiate a temporary ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine, but only succeeded in getting the 2 countries to agree to temporarily halt attacks on energy infrastructure. Peace talks.